Well, we started the year with a quote attributed to Lenin, that there are decades when nothing happens and weeks when decades happen. But after we came off air last Saturday, it almost felt as if a decade happened in a single weekend. We witnessed the start of Operation Epic Fury, those joint American and Israeli strikes which assassinated Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And since then, the regional conflict has spilled into so many different countries. Overnight, in a social media post, President Donald Trump called for the unconditional surrender of Iran. And his Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, said the United States is just getting started in its military campaign.
Iran is hoping that we cannot sustain this, which is a really bad miscalculation. Our commitment to our mission objectives only increases as our advantages continue to increase. We've got no shortage of munitions. Our stockpiles of defensive and offensive weapons allow us to sustain this campaign as long as we need to. Again, our munition status only increases as our advantage increases. Our capabilities, we have only just begun to fight and fight decisively.
That's the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, speaking from Washington. Let's head straight to the region and hear from Yelda Hakim of Sky News UK, who joins us from Doha, the capital of Qatar. Yelda, thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thanks so much for having me, Nick.
Yelda, let's start with that demand from President Donald Trump overnight for Iran's unconditional surrender. The Iranian regime is brutal, murderous. It slaughters its own people to cling on to power. The notion of surrender to America, Yelda, presumably that is just anathema to Tehran.
Absolutely. And Nick, in the last 24 hours, Iran's foreign minister gave an interview to NBC News in the United States and said, you know what? Not only are we not going to surrender, but we welcome American boots on the ground. We welcome ground troops because we want to take you on. So it just gives you a sense that Iran may not be able to, and this regime may not be able to take on the United States and Israel's military superiority at this point or at any point, frankly, but they are fighting an asymmetric war. And we can see that by what they're doing in terms of drone warfare across the Gulf. And I'm currently in the Qatari capital, Doha, which has intercepted a number of drones, ballistic missiles. Just in the last 24 hours, I was in Jerusalem, where on a daily basis, we were dealing with a barrage of missiles coming from Iran and people were fleeing into bunkers. And of course, for the Iranian public, they don't have bunkers to hide in. Right now, the death toll is well over 1,200 across the region, including six American servicemen who were killed on the first day of the conflict. And 1,000 of those deaths is in Iran itself, which is being, frankly, just bombed, to smithereens parts of Tehran. Donald Trump has said that the number of munitions that they have used in the past week has been more than the shock and awe campaign that they had in Iraq in 2003.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. I know you've had an extraordinary week. I think you flew out of London on Saturday night to Jordan. I think then you got into Israel. You've been in Saudi Arabia. You're now in Qatar. So many perspectives you can bring. Give us a sense, Yelda, of the tensions in the region and give us a sense of how this conflict has spilled over into other countries. Has that surprised you, how quickly the conflict has spread, how intense the conflict has been?
Well, Nick, I think it surprised everyone, including the United States and Israel. I don't think that after their success, you know, the tactical success that they had on Saturday, when by Saturday evening we knew I landed in Amman in Jordan, and we suddenly got the news that the supreme leader had been killed in a single strike on Saturday morning when they started the operation. So it started off with how the Americans and the Israelis would have viewed success. They also then changed their objectives over the course of the week. So we've had a head-spinning number of reasons given to us by President Trump, by his Secretary of War, by his Secretary of State. Everything from regime change, which they later, you know, flipped and flopped on and said, no, it's not regime change that we're there to do. We actually want to go after their missiles and their missile launches. Then they talked about the nuclear facilities, taking those out. Then they talked about the fact that they didn't want, they've often referred to Iran as the octopus's head and all the proxies that they've had in the region, including Hezbollah. They wanted to take all of them out. But what we've seen from this regime is this attempt to basically draw in as many countries as possible. And I think that has surprised everyone, including the Gulf states. And we're seeing the number of these drones, which cost about $35,000, very, very cheap relative to the interceptors, which are well over $1 million, that try and take out these drones, targeting U.S. consulates, U.S. embassies, oil refineries. The energy infrastructure has been hit, civilian targets being hit. And we're hearing from, you know, this administration, the U.S. administration, calling on its civilians 5 days into this war. They asked for American civilians to evacuate on any commercial flights that they could take from 14 different countries and locations and territories. So it just gives you a sense. I mean, where are they going to get commercial flights? Airspace is closed. I've had to drive from Riyadh to Qatar, which took about 8 hours. Where are all these civilians going to go? There's thousands of them stranded across the Gulf.
Talk to us, Yolder, about Iran's strategy right now. Presumably hitting these Gulf states so hard, they are hoping the Gulf states will then exert pressure on the United States to ease off, to sort of bring its military campaign to an end more quickly. What do you see as Iran's strategy right now?
Well, Nick, if you look at what the objectives of both sides are, for President Trump, his objective now is to basically get in there, smash as much as he can with a rising death toll and hope that, you know, the polls don't and the people don't turn against him and he's able to have a swift end to this conflict, which they're now saying he began by saying it would take just a few days, then 4 weeks. And now he's saying, well, we'll end this war whenever we want to end this war. For the Iranian regime, this is about survival. So for them, they've, you know, focused on survival as a regime from day one, going back to 1979. For the last 47 years, this has been about, you know, how they can ensure that they distribute power across the board so that it's not just about personalities. So even though the supreme leader has been killed, you know, they've basically have already replaced him. And the front runner is his son, Mujtaba Khamenei, who's 56 years old. And they say that he's taken over, but they don't want to make a big announcement because basically the Israeli Defense Force has said any other replacement is fair game. So for the Iranian regime, it's about survival. It's about consistency. So keeping everything going within the regime. And they've also said the Revolutionary Guard, which is, you know, the military force in Iran, but that also has economic interests and has a stranglehold on business and, you know, controls the Strait of Hormuz and the shipping lanes as well, for example, is basically acting independent from the government now. So the strategy you're seeing, the targeting of areas with drones, for example, is a plan that they put into place before this war began. And they're now carrying out those orders, which was discussed with the Supreme Leader long before they were hit.
I think that's fascinating, isn't it? That its leadership was decapitated in those early strikes, but power is dispersed in Iran, isn't it? There are layers and layers of succession planning for this very eventuality. But there is this sense that the number of ballistic missiles they're firing is not as many at the end of the week as it was earlier in the week, that the drones aren't coming in such numbers. Is there a sense that its capacity to fight is being downgraded?
You know, it's difficult to know exactly how many ballistic missiles they have. And the Iranians claim that they have, for example, hypersonic missiles and cruise missiles. They've also got these drones, you know, that we've seen them use against the Ukrainians that they've supplied to the Russians as well, for example. And so just to go back to my earlier point, these drones are very cheap. And I tried to explain it to someone the other day. So the interceptors that the Americans and American allies like Israel, for example, they're like Lamborghinis. They're very expensive, they're very difficult to make, and it takes a long time to make them. what we're seeing with these drones, they're like Toyota Corollas. So the production line, for example, is fast, it's cheap, and therefore very effective. Because you don't want to use a $1 million interceptor to take on a $35,000 drone that's coming in and smashing into, you know, an oil refinery or an embassy or a consulate or a residential area. So that's where the disparity is. And now, as I said, when I was in Israel, the barrage of missiles coming our way seemed to be, you know, 5 or 6 times in a day. Now, for the last 2 days that I was there, it started to slow down. It's difficult to know whether they are running short on supply. The Iranians are using bluster and saying, we're not short and we have the capability to defend ourselves for as long as we need to. But Israeli intelligence and US intelligence is saying they are now starting to run low because the Americans and the Israelis have been specifically targeting not just their missiles, but the missile launches as well. So they can't actually launch the missiles, you know, even though they may have the supplies, because the launches are being hit as well.
Yelda, you have had an extraordinary week. And in the midst of it, I want to acknowledge and congratulate you for winning the Royal Television Society's Presenter of the Year. you weren't at the award ceremony because you were on the ground. And I suspect that's one of the many reasons why you won this award, because you are one of those anchors, Yelda, who gets out there and reports. I just want to, you know, Australia has so many brilliant journalistic experts. You are foremost amongst them. And I just wanted to say, you know, congratulations on winning that award, and congratulations for all the reporting you've done.
Thank you so much, Nick. And of course, you know, you and I were colleagues together at the BBC, and you were a lost Briton, but Australia's win. And, you know, you and I have sort of swapped places. But thank you. It was a real honour, as you say. And, you know, I couldn't be there, of course, but I sent a video message. It was a great night. But, you know, we were in the midst of this massive war. And it goes back to what I said on the night, that, you know, serious international journalism is not optional. It's essential. People want to know what is going on across the globe at all times. And just when we think, you know, is journalism and is serious journalism relevant, a world war, you know, sort of erupts in this way. And people are asking me, is this World War III? And it's like, well, it might not be World War III, but there is a lot going on and we need to pay close attention. And that is why, you know, impartial, trustworthy journalism is so essential right now.
Yelda Hakeem, you are always there to bear witness. Thank you so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you so much, Nick.
Stream any ABC radio station live and on the go. Discover new podcasts, music, and audiobooks, all free on the ABC Listen app.